Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to the IRG's Health Matter Podcast. This is a podcast where we talk about various health topics, and we're excited today. We're joined by Dr. Jamie Antoine, orthopedic surgeon, sports medicine specialist, that's going to discuss today that syndesmosis or high ankle injury, kind of what is it, what are the causes, and then more importantly, how do you treat it and how do you fix it? Dr. Antoine, how are you doing?
Doing well, Shannon. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for joining us. Hey, I always like to kind of talk about your background. I mean, just for our listeners here, what I know about Dr. Antoine is Dr. Antoine grew up on the East Coast, if I remember, and Dr. Antoine played Division I hockey, right?
I did, yeah. So I actually grew up in Toronto, up in Canada, and I played Division I hockey in college at Union College in upstate New York.
Union College, upstate New York, did your undergrad there. And then tell us about your medical school, your training, kind of your interest in becoming an orthopedic surgeon. Let's talk about kind of that journey.
Sure, yeah. So after college, I went to medical school in upstate New York as well at Albany Medical College, and sort of always went into it knowing I was looking to get into sports medicine, really just with my sports background. That's what interested me. And so went in looking to get into that field, and that led to orthopedics as a specialty. Knew I wanted to do a surgical variation of sports medicine rather than primary care. And then from there went on to University of Washington, and that's how I ended up in the Seattle area to do my orthopedic residency, and then did a sports medicine fellowship down with Dr. King, who was the head physician for the Oakland Raiders down in Palo Alto. And then I've been back here practicing for 16 years.
Wow. Well, tell the listeners about that fellowship. I always like to kind of drill down into that fellowship, Barry, because when you say you're an orthopedic surgeon, but you have a sports medicine background, i.e. a sports medicine fellowship with Dr. King, Oakland Raiders. I mean, basically, for our listeners, explain that 1 year of very, what I would probably assume is intensive training, getting a lot of experience in the sports world. Maybe describe your fellowship.
Yeah, exactly. Really, it's after you're done your residency, you could go out and practice. You could be fully licensed orthopedic surgeon and go out in the community. But many of us choose to do a fellowship, and that's really a 1 year intensive, almost apprenticeship under folks that we kind of consider experts in the field. In sports medicine, always great to link up with someone who's taking care of professional athletes, and so I had great exposure with him, taking care of the Raiders, who were in Oakland at that time, of course, and covering practices 2 days a week, and covering games as well as some other sports teams, national rugby teams, and some local colleges as well.
Yeah, how cool is that? That must have been really a fantastic experience with a lot of training and just what you learned there. And you brought it back up here to the Pacific Northwest. You're presently working in the Kirkland area with Pro Ortho, which is a orthopedic group that does outpatient and surgeries and sports medicine. You name it, you all do it over there. Your special interest, again, is sports medicine. Tell our listeners about your practice, maybe a day in the life of Dr. Antoine.
Yeah, I'd say depending on the day of the week, it's a pretty good split between doing surgeries on some days and being in the office on other days. And so, enjoy being in clinic and seeing, spending time with new patients and follow-up patients as well after surgery. And also a variety of patients really in age from, children with fractures, but largely kind of a younger active population with maybe sports-related problems, but also older patients who are, still active or have degenerative problems and need things like joint replacement or non-surgical treatment as well.
Yeah, I mean, you, and not only do you have a fellowship, but I mean, I'm looking at your bio and kind of looking at some of the special training you have in your practice. I mean, here's a certified in robotic assisted knee replacement, MACI procedure, which is a matrix induced autologous cartilage implantation, seamless shoulder replacement options. Not just do you have a fellowship, but you've done a lot of work within your professional training to stay updated on the latest procedures and the latest advancements, technology. We know technology is moving fast. Maybe talk about some of the things I just discussed and talked about there and some of the training you do in addition to just your day-to-day kind of work.
Yeah, so I think you're always looking to know what's out there and to improve as the time goes by, which it does quickly. And so sometimes the techniques and the way we did things in training, change and evolve, and So, you know, I'm someone who I think tries to keep up on these things and what the literature and the evidence suggests. And so some of those additional trainings will involve, you know, taking time out to go to courses and become certified before you can use those things. In particular, you mentioned robotic assisted joint replacement, you know, and so that's something that adds a little accuracy and precision, we think, to doing joint replacements. You know, things, there's another procedure that I'll do called the 10X procedure, you know, less invasive way to treat chronic tendon problems, like tennis elbow or Achilles tendonitis. And so, just taking time out to look into some of these techniques that seem to have some good evidence, to support them as being a better way maybe to do things compared to traditional ways.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I've been doing this a long time. I've been doing physical therapy for about 35, 36 years. I mean, who's counting anymore, right? I just love the profession. But more importantly, I mean, the things that probably both you and I have seen just in our journeys in medicine, the technology and the advancements in technology. I mean, you're talking about a stemless shoulder replacement. You're talking about matrix-induced cartilage implantation. I mean, just but back to that robotic-assisted knee replacement. Just so our listeners know, I mean, the robot is not doing the procedure. The surgeon is still doing the procedure. The robot is there. Maybe talk about how the robot helps you in that procedure.
Yeah, exactly. That's correct. And that, you know, the saw is still in my hand. There's a robotic arm that's there. And really what it does as far as improving accuracy is we get a CAT scan of the patient's knee, and then we use software to make a 3D model of the joint. And so that allows us to make a preoperative plan as far as implant size, what cuts we need to make for precision, and we can actually do the operation essentially virtually on the computer in the room or before that as far as planning, and then just execute when we go. And so what the robotic arm will do with the saw with my hand on it is it will actually only allow me to cut and remove bone that we have planned on removing. So as soon as that saw would change an angle or go off of where we want to cut, it actually won't cut there. And so it really improves or increases accuracy and precision of making the cuts and doing the surgery that I thought I wanted to do there, compared to maybe conventional techniques, which are also very good. But it improves that precision and improves the safety a little bit as well.
Well, not only just by improving the precision and safety and of the surgery, I mean, I'm sure for the patient, I mean, I would imagine that improves just the outcomes, the results, allows the patient to get back to get to rehab quicker and maybe return to functional pain-free activities quicker just based on the technology you just described. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I'd say there's some studies that will show maybe less pain early on, and I think probably less due to less trauma to the tissues when we're making those right. cuts. Mm-hmm. Jury's still out on long-term outcomes, I would say, with that, but we think more accurate placement, it would make sense, will lead to better long-term outcomes and yep. as far as loosening. Yeah.
Yeah, the technology is fascinating. Speaking of technology, we're going to talk about an injury that we often hear, particularly in athletics, and you see it a lot on the football field. This is what we call a high ankle sprain, and a high ankle sprain is different than what we call a low ankle sprain because of the place where the injury occurs, the type of tissue that's disrupted. Let's talk about a high ankle sprain. First of all, I have to ask, as an athlete yourself, Dr. Antoine, have you ever had a high ankle sprain?
You know, at the time, I don't think I knew, but in retrospect, as I learned about these things, I think I did. I remember the mechanism quite well as a freshman in practice and having the classic mechanism, which we'll get into. So I believe I have treated without surgery.
Yeah, let's talk about the anatomy of a high ankle sprain. And we're talking about a high ankle sprain because it's not at the ankle joint, it's above the ankle joint. And maybe walk our listeners, I know we're on the radio here, but maybe describe the anatomy of a high ankle sprain, the location, then we'll talk about the mechanism, the diagnosis. We'll get the whole gamut here. We're going to go A to Z of a high ankle sprain.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the basic anatomy to understand is, you know, two bones in the leg that come down in our shin. The large one is called the tibia and the small one is called the fibula. So the bump that we can feel on the outside of our ankle is the end of the fibula bone, and that's called the lateral malleolus. And so when we have a typical ankle sprain where your foot ends up twisting underneath your leg and somewhat inwards, what is injured in that injury, the low ankle sprain, is a ligament that connects from the end of that fibula bone to the major bone in your foot. And so high ankle sprain is different in that the connection between those large bones in our ankle and in our leg are held by very strong ligaments. And that connection is called the syndesmosis. And so the high ankle sprain is an injury to that upper area where the two bones are held together called the syndesmosis.
Yep. And then the syndesmosis, that tissue and the amount of tissue is really kind of problematic sometimes. And that's why these high ankle sprains sometimes take more time to heal than a typical lower ankle sprain. The mechanism of injury is described that because we've all seen, particularly that football player on the field, and you look at it and you see the rotation and what's going on there. And you go high ankle sprain. Maybe describe the mechanism of injury.
Yeah, so exactly as you discussed, they're a pretty classic one where you'll see often the ball carrier in football, and the mechanism is really where the foot is getting rotated externally or out towards the side away from the body relative to the leg. And so what happens in practicality is that the runner has their leg on the ground, and they're often tackled from behind, and we see the foot is still on the ground, and then the runner goes down with their leg twisting inward away from that foot on the ground. And that creates an external rotation stress to that ankle.
And that rotational stress, I mean, again, when you talk about that tib-fibula junction there, that syndesmosis, what that rotational stress does is kind of irritates and sometimes tears that tissue between those two bones, what we sometimes refer as the interosseous membrane. So you get a bunch of tissue damage, you get a bunch of inflammation, a significant amount of pain, and usually the athlete kind of knows, hey, wow, what happened there? I mean, maybe describe some of the symptoms post-injury and what that athlete might experience post-injury and then maybe a couple days after injury.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the way, again, as an athletic trainer or physical therapist or physician, that we see it right away is that pain will tend to be above the ankle joint by several centimeters. And it can even, athlete can even have pain going up the leg quite a distance because, as you said, that injury can be an injury to the membrane that's holding those two bones together, and that can go quite a ways up. So there'll typically be a lot of swelling above the level of the bones of the ankle and down to the ankle itself, even higher in the leg. Often it will be difficult or not possible to bear any weight on that. And certainly to go up on tippy toes is often a telltale sign if the athlete can't do that, that you have a significant injury there.
Yeah, and then so when you suspect this injury, I mean, a patient, let's just talk about, let's just refer to, and we'll talk about an athlete. An athlete sustains this on the field. The athletic trainer, physical therapist assesses that, hey, you know, you got to go see the doctor, and that patient shows up at your office and walks in. You go, oh, okay. And you're going to do a history physical, but what's in your toolbox to really definitively diagnose that high ankle sprain versus a low, a fracture? How do you rule everything out?
Yeah, so certainly the history and physical is key, as you mentioned, physical examination and history. Where is the pain? What sort of things hurt? And so once we do suspect injury potentially in that area or the ankle itself, of course, the first thing we start with are plain x-rays to rule out fractures, because we can have high ankle sprains or syndesmosis injuries that occur with fractures, and those are actually quite common. So plain x-rays would be the first step typically. And with those x-rays, we can look to see, are there fractures or breaks of the bone of the ankle, or is there a spreading apart or widening between those two bones, between the tibia and the fibula. So we can sometimes see that right away on x-rays. If those x-rays are normal, then the next standard tool that we'll use is what we call stress x-rays. And so if we stress the ankle under x-ray by recreating that rotational force, what we're looking for is there a more subtle gapping or spreading apart of those bones, and often compare that to the patient's opposite side, looking for side-to-side differences.
Yeah, so, I mean, for our listeners out there, what you're actually looking for, if that tissue, that syndesmosis tissue or interosseous membrane we've talked about, if that is significantly torn and disrupted, what you're saying on x-ray, you can see, well, let's call it, I mean, just for lack of a better word, splain or a separation of the tib and fib. That gap gets bigger. You can see it on x-ray, and it gets bigger if you do a live x-ray with rotation of the lower extremity. Kind of, and that's how you're assessing that gap?
Exactly right. We're holding holding the leg steady with one hand and then rotating the foot with the other hand to look at that that gap.
Okay, do you guys, I mean, I know you surgeons, I mean, you like to put a grade on everything, and not just you guys, but everybody in everybody in medicine, we like to grade it. So how, I mean, do you grade these things based on the amount of tissue disruption, swelling, inflammation, pain, and then obviously looking at this gap or this syndesmosis joint that's spread out? I mean, tell us about kind of how you grade this and what you're looking at and then your treatment options from there.
Yeah, you know, really you're trying to figure out without the grading system itself, you can kind of get into grading, but at the end of the day, we want to separate unstable versus stable.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So we can have sprains of that which are stable, and we're trying to prove that it's a stable injury with our evaluation. And so there can be different predictors of that stability. And so one of them is the stress x-ray. That's one way to look at that. So with that plain x-ray, we're probably not grading it too much, but the kind of simple grading system that typically will apply for most injuries is if we have sort of a sprain, we'll call that a grade one injury, where the structures have been stressed and strained, but we don't have significant tearing of those structures. And then a grade two type of injury would be a partial tear of that versus a complete tear, which would typically be a grade three. Those type of diagnoses are probably best made with an MRI, which would be another tool to use. For syndesmosis, there's kind of more specific grading system based on the ligaments that are torn, where threes and fours would be the unstable type, where you have tearing of the back part of the syndesmosis, or what we call the posterior tib-fib ligament back there. And that would typically mean it's unstable and change treatment.
Got it. Okay, so I mean, it's fair to say here that if you grade that and look at that, grade one to two, you're probably going to go a conservative approach. I mean, I would imagine, you know, rest, physical therapy, strength, function, proprioception, return to activities, you know, and then, I mean, anything in the two or three, this is a injury that probably needs, if you're calling it instability, it probably needs some stability. Is that right?
Correct. Exactly right.
And so I would imagine, okay, so if I go back 20 years ago and I had patients that had this, I mean, you all used to put these big screws through this syndesmosis and maybe talk about how it used to be repaired and then the technology with this, this tightrope procedure. Okay, let's do that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, if we determine it was an unstable type of injury, then historically the treatment would be to close down that splaying or gap in the operating room under x-ray, which we still do. But then we have to think about how are we going to stabilize this and hold it in place while the ligaments heal. And so we don't need to directly go down and sew the ligaments together. We just put the bones in their proper relationship while it heals. And so, as you said, Shannon, historically that's been done by putting one or two screws through the fibula into the tibia bone to hold those together while the ligaments heal.
And so when you do that in the old technique, that screw would go in there, and that was probably immobilized, I would imagine, just biology. That probably takes what? I mean, I'm guessing, 8 to 10 weeks or something where they're just healing. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So typically we would have that patient not weight-bearing for the first 6 weeks because, again, we don't trust that they can walk on that without splaying it apart while things are healing. And yes, you're probably not putting any high stress on that for, you know, 10 to 12 weeks typically. Mm-hmm. And then one of the potential drawbacks or downsides is now you have these screws yep. across a body part that typically does have a little bit of motion.
Yep.
And so there's been some concern about over tightening or constraining that. The screws, if left in place, typically would be expected to break once the patient returns to walking because there is motion there.
Yeah.
And so for that reason, historically, many surgeons have gone back and performed a second operation to remove the screws before there's much weight bearing.
Wow, wow. And but let's talk about, you also mentioned, I believe I heard you say, you know, you're also looking at that and grading that. You're assessing not only the distance in that syndesmosis or that splaying, you also have to assess, well, how much is that tissue disrupted, torn? And then do you need, as a surgeon, do you sometimes need not only to reapproximate the bones and bring that syndesmosis back together, but also repair that soft tissue or what we call that interosseous tissue? Do you have to repair it sometimes?
Yeah, there can be cases where that's being done more and more. And so now we're starting to see more use of putting a scope in the ankle and taking a look at some of these things. And then, yes, there are techniques to do direct repairs of the anterior, the ligament there in the front that tears, or even interosseous ligament.
Wow, that's interesting. Okay, so, I mean, for our listeners, again, I know we're on the radio, but I just want everybody to appreciate this joint, okay? Like Dr. Antoine just said, you have these two bones, the tibia and fibia. I mean, when you're walking and your foot is pronating and supinating or rolling in and out and you're moving around, those bones are translating a kind of side to side, up and down, vertical a little bit, up and down. Not only that, and those two bones at the bottom, where we call the malleoli, you have the lateral and the medial malleoli, those bones are then coming together to form what we call a mortise joint. And that mortise joint holds, and what fits in that is the top of your ankle bone called the talus. So, I mean, this is a really cool joint. It's a really cool area of the body, but it's got a lot of mechanics, okay? And so let's talk about kind of this tightrope procedure and this new technique and how it's so much better. I can just imagine it's so much better to not have metal or screws that could potentially break, or then the surgeon has to go back in and take these out. Talk about the tightrope procedure.
Yeah, so really what the tightrope procedure does is kind of replace some of those challenges or issues we talked about with rigid fixation. So the way to think about a tightrope fixation is really what we're using is a very strong suture, almost like a cable, and that helps connect the bones together and is held on either side of the fibula or the tibia by a metallic button. So essentially, we can pass a metallic button through holes in the bone and have those attached to either side, and then cinch that down to tighten that joint down and hold it in place. And so that's a very high strength but flexible fixation device.
And what is the surgical approach? I mean, is this a small incision? Is this, compared to what maybe you had to do, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, whatever it might be, your approach, the procedure, the time, the length, maybe give me some comparatives when we talk about before and now.
Yeah, I would say if we're doing just an isolated high ankle sprain, as far as the approach to the surgery and the incisions, they're fairly similar because I don't need to make much of a big incision to put a screw or two in from the outside part of the ankle. Yeah. So we make a little incision over the fibula bone on the outside, and then we want to make sure the joint is lined up properly. And again, as you said, Shannon, the way that joint kind of works is the fibula bone fits into a slot almost on the side of the tibia. So if listeners can sort of think about this thing needing to kind of find its home and slot itself in, we use a large clamp to do that and hold those together. And then under X-ray guidance, I can drill holes, watching the drill go through the bones where I want to, at the level a little bit above the joint, and then pass the device through.
Wow. And then, so on this tightrope, I mean, you're basically drilling a tunnel, let's call it a tunnel, and you're drilling a tunnel and you're passing that suture through there to the other side on the outside of the tibia, I would imagine. Then you have a button that pops, I'm just trying to mechanically understand this, pops out, and then you just cinch that rope up or cinch those sutures up and reapproximate that syndesmosis, right?
Exactly right. And as you asked before, the whole procedure probably takes about 20 to 25 minutes to do.
Okay. So how do you know, you talked about that, you can see the fit and you're doing it. I think for our listeners, I mean, you call this fluoroscopy when you're like looking at an X-ray or looking at tell us about the technology that you're visualizing, how tight to put that cinch or that suture. How do you make sure that you're getting that fibula and tibia back into place where it should be going? I mean, what are you using there? You talked about, it's important that you reapproximate that joint. What's the technology there?
Yeah, exactly. So fluoroscopy is just a live X-ray essentially that we have in the room, and it can take static or still shots, but it could also take live shots if you wanted to see something moving. So essentially, we're looking to make sure on multiple views that we've restored normal alignment on X-ray. Wow. And we've gotten rid of that splaying there as well. And so, like I said, some folks will also use arthroscopy to directly look at that as well. Yeah. Yeah. Make sure that you've closed that down.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, I've always had a lot of respect for what you do, Dr. Antoine. I mean, obviously, you know, being an athlete yourself and experiencing injuries and playing at a level that you did. And then obviously when you have a patient and you're looking at someone who has a injury like this, syndesmosis, high ankle that needs surgery, you're not only looking at how do I repair this and what does the present repair look like and what do I need to do to fix this? But you also as a surgeon have to go, well, what is this going to look like for this person in their life? You know, I mean, 5, 10, 15, 20 years, how do I prevent, you know, I imagine you're thinking, you know, how do I get this back in line? How do I prevent any premature arthritis or, you know, weakness? Or, I mean, how do you get this person back to functional activities? You're thinking through a lot of puzzle type situations. I mean, is that right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, as I tell patients, most of the time when we do things to fix injuries, a lot of times it isn't necessarily to get that to heal, but it's to prevent future trouble, right?
Yes, right.
Arthritis, chronic pain, or chronic instability. So that's exactly right. And so lining this back up, we call a reduction, is the key really to the whole thing. And so one of the benefits of this tightrope that we have found, and multiple studies have shown this, that actually the reduction, the lining up of those bones is more accurate using the tightrope. And that's probably the number one most important thing, because that's going to prevent late problems of pain or instability or arthritis. And so it's actually been shown that flexibility, rather than the rigid screws, probably helps the bone find its way into that groove and settle in naturally where it's supposed to be as we're reducing.
Ah, I like that. I like that description. Hey, just out of curiosity, that tightrope, that suture you described, that cable, is that something that just stays there? Does it get picked up by the body? Is absorbed by the body? Or is that something that the patient has for life?
Yeah, that's something that stays there for life. And so your body doesn't react to it.
Okay.
So inert kind of metals. And again, that's one of the benefits of that tightrope, is because one of the pitfalls of the screw technique is late splaying or late, you know, late loss of that reduction, particularly after those screws are removed. Then one can all of a sudden spread their syndesmosis again. And that's a much harder problem to deal with.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I'm trying to think as we're talking here, I'm almost positive, and I could be wrong, but there's been some pretty high-level names, I mean, particularly in the NFL. I mean, I'm just going to throw this out because I can't remember, but did Cooper Kupp, a wide receiver for the LA Rams, did he have this procedure? I mean, did he have a tightrope, or is it someone else I'm thinking about? I mean, maybe you don't remember. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't remember if he did. I know one of the more popular ones in the last several years was in Alabama, and Tua Tagovailoa.
Oh, that's right. That's yep. Go ahead.
Yep. And even and Hertz had it done in the same season as well.
Yeah, that's the one. You're right. That's the one I'm thinking about. Tua, who now is the quarterback at Miami. Yeah, he had that done. He had this procedure done, and if I remember right, gosh, it was only like, I mean, was it 2 weeks? And he played in some bowl game or something. How long did he rehab and get back to playing? It was pretty quick, wasn't it?
He was back playing in a game in 4 weeks.
Yeah, I know that's it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so he was, you know, pretty well publicized case. And so, certainly in those higher level athletes, again, we don't know how bad their injury was, but those high ankle sprains, even when not completely displaced, can keep people out typically at least 6 to 8 weeks, as you know.
Yeah.
Certainly in that population, folks have been able to get back sooner with decreased risk of re-injury during that rehab period, which was really the pitfall in the past.
Right, right. And I think you mentioned it earlier in the podcast here, we were discussing, and you said that a lot of times when you have this rotational high ankle syndesmosis injury, you can sometimes break off that, particularly on the lateral side, which would be the fibula or the lateral malleoli. And that is not uncommon that you have to go in as a surgeon, not only fix that distal fracture of the fibula, but you also have to do the syndesmosis repair. And then maybe just, you know, describe that fracture that happens mostly on the lateral side, I assume.
Yeah. And so what you'll see with that external rotation injury is that lateral malleolus or fibula bone, the way to think about it, as you described the anatomy before with that talus, and the medial and the lateral malleolus are sort of like the house containing that and that mortise. And so as the bone rotates out, very commonly it will create a fracture, a spiral type of fracture of the lateral malleolus. And then in addition, actually, Shannon, is quite common then to pull off the medial malleolus with a ligament that's attached there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so that combination is the one that is often then going to be associated with the high ankle sprain or syndesmosis injury that we need to fix as well.
Yeah. And so you're not only fixing the syndesmosis, you're going in there and probably putting a plate if that fracture is needing a plate is disrupted or broken apart. I guess you'd probably put a plate in both those malleoli and fix those most likely.
Yeah. Typically you'll put a plate on the lateral side and two screws on that medial side. And then once the bones are fixed, of course, because you can't check the syndesmosis for stability when the bones are broken.
Right.
So once I fix the fibula and fix the bones, then I can test the syndesmosis to see if that's okay, if the ligaments are okay. And then historically, I would have put an additional screw through the plate across the two bones. Now with some of those devices, I can put the tightrope button and it fits right in the plate hole. And so we can incorporate the tightrope fixation through the plate and not have to worry about going back and taking screws out.
Man, Dr. Antoine, I mean, this information is awesome. I mean, you know, when you do these procedures, let's talk about an athlete or someone, even an adult recreational athlete, and they want to get back to activity. I mean, you know, full return to activity after a procedure like a tightrope for a syndesmosis injury. I mean, are you talking 3 to 4 months? Are you talking 5 months? What are you seeing?
Yeah, I think, again, it depends on the type, the grade of the injury and associated things that are hurt. But yeah, it's usually a fairly, long recovery. I would say typically, 3 to 4 months at least for folks, depending on, heavy labor, right, what type of sports are involved in. But certainly for a lower grade type of injury in folks who are looking for a more accelerated pathway, like some of these high level athletes we talked about, it can be done to get these folks back in 4 to 6 weeks. But again, that's with very intense rehab and therapy.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Antoine, I can tell just talking to you, you love your work. You love your job, don't you?
Absolutely. Love it.
I mean, my gosh, I mean, what you just described, you got me excited not to get injured. I mean, I don't want to have an injury, but it's exciting to constantly, I mean, it's almost every time or every week we pick up literature, look at, the news, I mean, the media, I mean, the advancements in medicine right now and some of the stuff that you're doing surgically through the scope, minimally invasive surgery, the biologics that are out there, the things that we're learning about, tendinopathy. I mean, it's exciting right now to be in healthcare and particularly medicine. And it's exciting for our patients because you and I both know as a surgeon, as a physical therapist, I mean, the joy that we have is watching someone come into our office and they're in pain and they've lost their ability to be functional. And you get to return that, decrease the pain, and return them back to pain-free functional activities. I mean, I sometimes feel like I never have had to work a day in my life, and I can tell that's how you feel. And you're great. Thank you for joining us on IRG's podcast. This is our Health Matters podcast. Hey, how do you get a hold of yourself? We've got listeners out there going, why don't I want to talk to this guy? I've got something going on. How would our listeners get a hold of you? I mean, 1-800-HELP or what is it? I mean, I'm just kidding.
Well, yeah. So probably the easiest thing on the, on the smartphone is, pull out the link to the website. You can find me at www.proortho.com. You can also find me directly at my website to make an appointment that way, or look at maybe some procedures or medical education. And that's at AntoineOrthopedics.com. And then our phone to call for direct appointing is 425-823-4000.
Dr. Antoine, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for a wonderful discussion on a syndesmosis injury and a tightrope fixation. We have to have you come back on. I'd like to talk to you about some other things that you're doing in the sports world. I mean, let's agree to talk again in the future, okay?
Absolutely. Always a pleasure.
Me too. Thank you for your time.